This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of Worldwide Wave, the international LGBT news and current affairs show, every week on Australia's first LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the Worldwide Wave.
This is Worldwide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show for and by the LGBTI community, taking you around the globe one queer story at a time. I'm Matt, and spread out COVID safely and masked up across Melbourne with a bigger gap than the Biden-Trump election results. Welcome tonight to the Worldwide Wave panel of Shannon.
Hey, everybody.
Hello, Paul.
Good evening.
Good evening, Stefan.
Hello.
Trans rights have taken a battering under President Donald Trump. But with the calling of the US election result for President-elect Joe Biden, expectations for improvements in LGBTI rights are high. That drive for change may be made a little easier with the election of the first transgender state senator in the US, Sarah McBride. Sarah won her race in the small US state of Delaware.
Senator-elect Sarah McBride is no stranger to advocacy, having served as the National Press Secretary for activist group, the Human Rights Campaign. She's an activist who came out as a transgender woman while president of a university's student body. She's worked inside politics, including as a White House intern during Barack Obama's term, and continues to drive change for LGBTI Americans. She came into the Joy Studios on a visit to Melbourne before she began her successful campaign.
Here's a taste of what's coming up tonight.
And so having the support of my family, it is not hyperbole to say that it was life-saving for me. And that when transgender people are able to be embraced and loved by their families and their communities, by their governments, it doesn't just send a positive message to those transgender people. It doesn't just protect them from discrimination. It can literally be the difference between life and death.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like Worldwide Wave on Facebook now.
Sarah McBride has been an activist and political campaigner for most of her life. In 2011, Sarah was elected student body president at the American University. During her last week at the student body president, McBride gained international attention when she came out as a transgender woman in her college newspaper, The Eagle. In 2012, she interned in Barack Obama's White House, becoming the first openly transgender woman to work there in any capacity. She worked in the White House Office of Public Engagement and Intergovernmental Affairs, where she worked on LGBTI issues. In a speech in 2015, Second Lady Jill Biden told Sarah's story, saying, "We believe young people should be valued for who they are, no matter what they look like, or where they're from, the gender which they identify, or who they love." Now, Sarah McBride has become the first trans state senator-elect in the United States history. Prior to her campaign, she visited Joy 94.9 studios and spoke to Ian Muchmore for Worldwide Wave.
Sarah, welcome to Australia. Welcome to Worldwide Wave. What have you seen of Australian politics so far?
Well, this is actually my second time in Australia. I was here about a year and a half ago in Melbourne for the first national LGBTQ conference in Australia in about 40 years. It was right on the heels of marriage equality, of the marriage equality vote being implemented. Same-sex couples were just beginning to be allowed to marry here in Australia. So it was a momentous time, but I also think it was a time where a lot of folks in the community here in Australia were concerned about, will the momentum of our movement dissipate with the achievement of marriage, and will we be able to continue to move equality forward on a whole host of issues for LGBTI Australians without marriage equality as part of the driving force with that. But from what I've seen over the last year and a half, there has been continuing ongoing momentum to change policies as it relates to identity documents for transgender people here, to make sure that we're building more inclusive schools for LGBTI young people here in Australia. Obviously, there was a recent election.
What's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm extremely disappointed that Scott Morrison will be returning and staying on as prime minister. Even in the States, we are aware that Scott Morrison has spent his career opposing LGBTI equality. And so I'm deeply troubled by it. I'm disappointed. But I know that Australians will continue to rally and hopefully continue to move equality forward no matter who's prime minister.
So it sounds actually like you're quite well informed about LGBTI politics in Australia, which is super. How do you think politics and those political issues, those LGBT issues, compare here and the discussions here to how they are in the States? What are your observations?
Well, I think probably in many ways there are similarities in terms of how we talk about LGBT issues here in Australia versus here in the United States. I think there are some pretty significant differences. Here in Australia, there are nationwide non-discrimination protections for LGBT people. There are no explicit nationwide protections for LGBT people in the United States in employment, housing, public spaces. So I think we're in very different stages of our movement with different issues that are sort of at the forefront of what we're talking about. But when I was here in Australia a year and a half ago, one of the things that I did hear from activists was just how much anti-equality politicians and activists were targeting transgender youth. And that is a similar phenomenon in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in a lot of different English-speaking nations right now. And that's deeply troubling for me. So I think there are some similarities in the challenges that we're facing right now.
Now, I have friends and I have other people here, and they say to me, I'm not going to go to the US while Donald Trump is in power. What do you say to those people who might be skeptical or maybe fearful or feel that they don't want to support a regime while Donald Trump is in power? Do you think that's effective? Do you think it's the right thing, the right approach to take?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know whether it's helpful or hurtful with people saying, I'm not going to travel to the United States as long as Donald Trump is president. But I certainly understand that there is a crisis happening right now with Donald Trump in the White House, that Donald Trump represents our nation's worst sins and has emboldened those who wish to roll the clock back on our progress and license and in some cases mandate discrimination against LGBTQ people, against folks of color, against women, against immigrants, against Muslims, against folks living at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities. So I think right now we're in a crisis phase in American politics. That is calling on all of us in the United States to step up our activities, our actions, our organizing. And I think to the degree that we can have the support of folks around the world in pushing back against Donald Trump, that's helpful. And I think that can take a lot of different forms.
So you are tremendously clear in your advocacy. It's really quite inspiring to listen to you. And you come from Delaware. And I had to look up Delaware on.
So don't tell me that. That's the worst insult for a Delawarean to heal. Although we hear it all the time.
But I'm curious. What was it like to grow up in Delaware?
Delaware is a really close-knit state. We're a small state. We have less than 1 million people. And what I like to say is that Delaware is a state of neighbors. I have been exceptionally fortunate to have grown up in a state like Delaware, where I was met when I came out with a community that loved and embraced me, by a government that recognized that their job was to protect the dignity and rights of every person in our state, including transgender people, and stepped up to pass protections for transgender people. So, I'm very lucky to have been born in Delaware. It was a great place to be born and raised. It's a great place to live right now, where I work remotely for the Human Rights Campaign. We have a lot more work to do in Delaware, but I'm glad to say that it's a blue state, as we like to say, where we have elected officials who are committed to equality and committed to doing the work.
And you were political from a young age and from a political family. How important was the support of your family when you came out as a proud transgender woman?
The support of my family when I came out was life-saving. I remember after I came out, my father went online the night after I came out. It was Christmas Day in 2011. And he did what I had done every night for the previous 5 years. He Googled the word transgender. And he came across an aptly titled report called Injustice at Every Turn, which is put out by the National Center for Transgender Equality and the National LGBTQ Task Force. And in the survey and in the report, it documents that 41% of transgender people attempt suicide at some point in their lives. 41%. And that's not because transgender people are predisposed to attempt suicide. It's because society puts so many barriers in our way, so many obstacles to happiness and wholeness and fulfillment and community and love, that nearly half of transgender people decide that they would rather end their lives than exist in this world. But what he saw in that statistic was that when the transgender person is embraced by their community, that number drops significantly. And when they're embraced by their family, it drops even further. And so having the support of my family, it is not hyperbole to say that it was life-saving for me, and that when transgender people are able to be embraced and loved by their families and their communities, by their governments, it doesn't just send a positive message to those transgender people. It doesn't just protect them from discrimination. It can literally be the difference between life and death.
Absolutely. Maybe we could talk a bit about when you came out as transgender at American University. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that experience. So you were already involved in politics. You were a Democrat. You've been involved in campaigning. And then you put an article in, was it the newspaper was called The Eagle?
Yeah, the student newspaper at American University. I was serving as student body president at the time. When I came out, it was halfway through my term. And then with the courage and the confidence that my parents gave me in May of 2012, during the last day of my term, I came out as transgender in my student newspaper to my campus community. And, you know, I was very scared about the campus's response. It was 2012. It was before what our media had sort of dubbed the transgender tipping point. I didn't know how our campus would respond to really an out transgender student, let alone an out transgender student body president. But every response I got, every comment, every message, every interaction I had after I came out with my campus community and with my community back in Delaware was an interaction of love and support and an acceptance. But what was also very clear to me very quickly was that the experiences I had were unique. I looked around my campus, I looked around my community, and I looked around my country, and it was clear that for far too many transgender people, the experiences I had were a privilege for the few, not a right guaranteed to everyone. And at the end of the day, it shouldn't be a privilege to be able to keep your family after you come out. It shouldn't be a privilege to be able to keep your job or stay in school after you come out. And it certainly shouldn't be a privilege to be safe from violence. And so, as positive as that experience was, recognizing that coming out for me was the hardest thing that I had ever done up until that point, but was still so easy compared to the experiences of so many other people, it was through that recognition that I decided to be an activist and to try to make sure that the privileges that I have are no longer a privilege for the few.
Sarah McBride, now Senator-elect McBride, the first transgender senator in the USA on Joy 94.9.
Now, if the story tonight has raised any issues with you, there's lots of support available. Go to joy.org.au/support for all those services.
Coming up, we find out more about Sarah's journey to Senate. This is Worldwide Wave.
Hi, I am Tim.
And I'm Ben.
From Hallam, Melbourne.
And you are listening to the Worldwide Wave
on Joy 94.9.
Even though we are currently broadcasting outside of the studios, you can still message us via Facebook. It's Worldwide Wave or W3Joy. We'd love receiving your messages.
What might shock some of President Donald Trump's hardcore supporters? The USA has just elected its first trans state senator in Sarah McBride. The experienced political operative won a hometown seat of Delaware. At just 30 years old, she is now the most senior trans person in US politics and is part of a diverse group of LGBTIQ people to enter US politics from this election. Sarah spoke with Worldwide Wave in her former capacity of National Press Secretary for the activist group, the Human Rights Campaign.
It was at the Democratic Convention, and you were the first transgender woman to speak at the Democratic Convention, which endorsed Hillary Clinton. That really put you on the stage. You know, everyone tweeted that, everybody watched that. What was life like after that? Was that a pivotal point? Am I right in thinking that was one of the things? It was the day before and the day after was different?
Yeah. It's funny you mention that, because the day after I was driving with my mom and we went out to get Italian water ice in the middle of the day. It was summer of 2016. And I said, it feels so normal right now, but it also feels like everything's completely changed. Having the opportunity to speak at the Democratic National Convention was the greatest professional opportunity and responsibility of my life. It was really powerful to be in that arena, to watch an arena full of people applaud and cheer not my dignity, not my story, but the dignity and the stories and the rights of transgender people across the United States. And that was really, for so many transgender people, the first time we saw politics, which unfortunately, historically, is a cautious field, so clearly embrace our lives and our cause. And from that day on, I've had the opportunity to have my voice heard in big and small ways in the movement for equality in the United States, and to travel around the United States and increasingly the world talking about this.
So when you do become a public figure in 2019 and for several years now in social media, you're very exposed. What strategies do you have to deal with the hate and the abuse that inevitably comes with being in that public position? How do you mentally cope with that?
That's a really great question. And I think it's a question, it's one of the most significant questions we have, is how do we leverage the positive aspects of social media and the digital age where we have democratized the microphone? How do we as a society make sure that we're ensuring that that's allowing for diverse and marginalized voices to be heard and not just the overcrowding of those spaces into the comment sections of basically Fox News in the United States? And that's a big question for our society. But for me, in dealing with that hate and the bullying that I've seen online, I think I try to remember two different things. The first is that the glimpse that I have on my social media into that bullying is just a tiny reflection of what particularly LGBTQ young people are facing every single day. The second lesson I try to remember is one that I learned in probably the worst experience of online harassment that I had. And in 2016, before the convention, I took a selfie of myself in a bathroom in North Carolina that I was legally barred from being in after the North Carolina legislature had passed HB 2. And the post and the picture quickly went viral, and the responses that came in at first were incredibly positive. But then the more it spread across the internet, the more the responses were incredibly hateful. I mean, from threats of murder and sexual assault to the most common comment, which was three letters over and over again, KYS, 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 kill yourself, kill yourself, kill yourself, over and over again. And I was 25 at the time. I didn't think words on a screen could impact me as much, but it was the only period in time in my life where suicide became even a rational thought, because it was just so overwhelming. And even though I knew the news cycle would dissipate, I still just wanted out of it so badly. And after it finally did dissipate, I wondered, can I do this work? Can I be public as a transgender person in any kind of occupation? Because this is the inevitable byproduct, and I don't know if I have thick enough skin. And so I spent a lot of time reflecting and reading and listening to a lot of other folks who experience online harassment. And I came across an interview with a reporter who writes a lot about body positivity and her weight. Mm-hmm. And there was an interview with her that really helped to shift my perspective and help me deal a little bit more with the online harassment. And the lesson I took from it, which is that so often we say that the biggest bullies are oftentimes the biggest closet cases. And that might be true in certain instances, but it undervalues and diminishes a more universal truth, which is that everyone has an insecurity, whether it's their sexual orientation or their gender identity or how they look, what they do, how they sound, where they come from, no matter what it is, everyone has something that society has said they should be ashamed of or tried to hide. And the thing about LGBTQ people is that we have taken that fact, we have taken our insecurities, we have taken our biggest fears, and we've not only accepted them, but oftentimes we walk forward from a place of pride in them. And the bullies see that power. They see that individual agency in conquering our own fears, and they're jealous of it. And that was something that I needed to learn in order to be able to put 2 feet in front of the others and in order to continue to do this work, to recognize that the hate that comes my way, it's because I'm powerful.
Yes, so you are press secretary with Human Rights Campaign. Tell me a bit about what that organization does and what your priorities are and how you're making a difference.
Sure. So the Human Rights Campaign is the United States' largest LGBTQ civil rights organization. And we work to move equality forward at the local, state, and federal level with our legislative advocacy work, with our electoral work. We work to move LGBTQ inclusive policies forward in businesses and workplaces, in faith communities, in hospitals, in child welfare agencies across the United mm-hmm. States. And we've got a global program that works with activists and advocates around the world to bring them together, to use the convening power of our organization to help leverage best practices and support activists around the world doing hard work in places not just like the United States or Australia, but in countries where LGBTQ identities may still be criminalized, where LGBTQ people may still face the death penalty mm-hmm. for their mm-hmm. identities. It's a great place to work. My colleagues are incredible, a diverse reflection of the community that we seek to advocate for and advocate with. And I'm blessed every single day to have that job.
And clearly, you're very talented to do it. We have, week after week, stories of countries around the world with the sort of human rights issues that you're talking about. And we question, as a group of people on that show, as to what the response should be. And one of the responses might be that we boycott the country or we take some action against it. But what, in your experience, you're saying that the Human Rights Campaign works overseas. What are the tactics, what are the approaches that you think are effective and that you would recommend that we're more widely aware of? Because it seems quite limited sometimes what we think of as... We thought about Bahrain, about Brunei recently. Mm-hmm. And there was a big call there to boycott. But we also heard from some academics that perhaps that wasn't the approach to take. So how do you go about making a difference overseas?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that we try to be exceptionally aware of, particularly as an organization in the United States, is sometimes the counterproductive hand of either the U.S. government or U.S.-based organizations yeah. in trying to push forward change in countries and cultures that are very different than our own, particularly given the power of the United States and the role that it plays in the world. So we seek to make sure that we are, in our work, empowering the advocates and activists on the ground. Because the reality is that there are activists and advocates in every country around this world, even in countries where LGBTQ identities and organizing is totally criminalized. And for us, it's incredibly important that, you know, we don't shut off our ability to support LGBTQ or LGBTI activists in other countries, that we go where the need is. I mean, firefighters run into the building when it's burning. They don't run away from it. And I think that's so important in so much of what we do. Now, there are conversations around boycotts. There's conversations around, you know, international institutions or governments issuing sanctions when there's human rights violations. I think, you know, you have to be very careful when we're talking about that those actions and those activities don't unintentionally harm the very people who are being discriminated against or being killed or facing the persecution. And so it varies based, I think, on the country in terms of, or the circumstance in terms of what the answer is going to specifically be and how the world responds to injustice. But from our perspective in our work, we seek to try to make sure that whether you're an LGBTQ or LGBTI activist in Africa or South America or Asia or Europe, that you're getting support from us no matter the circumstances that you find yourself in.
Senator-elect Sarah McBride with us on Joy 94.9. Coming up, we find out more about Sarah's passion for LGBTIQ rights. This is World Wide Wave.
Hi, this is Patrick Smith, International Mr. Leather on World Wide Wave.
It's the show that takes you around the globe, one queer story at a time, World Wide Wave. And a special hello to everyone listening to us on podcast. You can subscribe to receive our podcast automatically either at joy.org.au/worldwidewave or on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast platform happens to be. And don't forget to always leave us a review.
After years of trans people being the subject of ridicule and the removal of their rights, the Biden administration will have a voice that can speak of the firsthand impacts to lawmakers. Sarah McBride has been elected as the first trans state senator in the state of Delaware. Prior to her campaign on a visit to Melbourne, Sarah stopped in at Joy 94.9 for an extended and thoroughly fascinating chat to World Wide Wave.
So when you say support, I just want to dig deeper. What does support actually look like?
So for us, one of the great programs that our global team works on is it brings together LGBTI activists and LGBTQ activists from around the world for our Global Ambassadors Program, which is a fully paid program where we bring 20 or 30 of leading activists from around the world together to talk about different strategies, to talk about different issues, to talk about methods for change. And those connections, they're not just beneficial for that week. Those are connections between activists around the world that last for a lifetime in this work. Now, the predominant focus of our organization is domestically in the United States. Our global team is doing incredible work, but the predominant focus of the human rights campaign is trying to make sure that we're moving forward equality in the United States. Right now, as I mentioned, the U.S. still has no clear protections from discrimination at the federal level. And so just this past Friday, the U.S. House of Representatives finally, for the first time in American history, passed a comprehensive LGBTQ civil rights bill. And that was a milestone for our movement. There's still a lot of work to do, but our focus remains on achieving full nationwide equality for LGBTQ people.
And you describe yourself as a policy geek. A policy nerd. So you've probably got a whole bunch of ideas about what you think needs to happen next. What would be on your wish list for what should happen next in changes in policy, especially in the US?
Well, I obviously, in terms of LGBTQ equality, the fact that LGBTQ people don't have clear protections is of the utmost urgency in passing. But beyond that, I want to make sure that we have healthcare that meets the needs, the diverse needs of our community, whether it's people living with HIV or transgender people seeking transition-related care. Far too many folks still find the care that they need out of reach, particularly in the United States, where we have far too many people without access to health insurance. We are constantly having conversations in the United States about how do we expand family-inclusive workplace policies. So the United States is the only industrialized nation that doesn't have paid family and medical leave for citizens across the United States. And when we are having that conversation in our politics about making sure that we move paid family and medical leave forward, we're also working to make sure that that's inclusive of LGBTQ families and LGBTQ people and their needs. So there's a number of different issues beyond sort of the sexual orientation and gender identity explicit policies that we seek to push forward. But I'll tell you the one that's on my mind the most right now is we just saw a spree of killings of transgender women, all three black transgender women in the United States over the last 2 weeks. And the violence against the transgender community in the United States is an epidemic, and it is an issue that requires urgent action from individuals, from policymakers, from governments, because it is a crisis that is resulting in the deaths of far too many transgender people every single year, particularly Black transgender women. And this epidemic over the last three weeks in the United States has only grown in its cruelty, in its urgency. And that one is an issue that haunts me. I know it haunts so many LGBTQ people and activists in the United States. And that's one that we need urgent action on. Not tomorrow, not next week, not next year. We need it now.
We need that on the agenda. You're out here to talk on a panel for a book which is called The Children of Harvey Milk by Andrew Reynolds. And the key theme of the book is about LGBTI representation in elected officials. How much further do we need to go in the representation of LGBTI people in elected office, and especially, I suppose, transgender people as well?
We have a long way to go. The fact remains that in the United States, the percentage of LGBTQ people in public office is very small, particularly when compared to the overall community. We're making progress. This new Congress in the United States has more openly LGBTQ members than in history. Unfortunately, it's still only 10.
And transgender
people? And there are no transgender people in Congress at this point in the United States. We have 4 openly transgender people in state legislatures. So we only have 4 openly transgender people in the roughly, 5,000 or so local or state legislative seats in the United States. So we have a long way to go to make sure that the representation we have increases in the overall numbers, but also increases in reflecting the broad diversity of our community. One of the great things we saw in 2017, it was this sort of wave of openly transgender candidates. We saw 2 transgender people elected to the 13-member Minneapolis City Council. Mm-hmm. So the Minneapolis City Council has 13 members, 2 of whom are transgender people of color, which is incredible. I'd like to see more of that kind of representation on city councils, state legislatures, and yes, the U.S. Congress moving forward.
So I have to ask, Sarah, do you have political aspirations?
You know, I am very lucky to have the job right now that I have, and I think we are at a pivotal moment in the fight for LGBTQ equality, and I feel like this is a job that gives me the opportunity to make change. But I also think what I've always thought, which is that politics is the place where every avenue of society converges and you can make the most amount of change for the most amount of people in the most number of ways in the quickest time possible. So I think it's something that might be for me down the road. But right now, I'm really focused on moving equality forward in the United States, defeating the politics of hate, and making sure that LGBTQ people are finally clearly protected from discrimination, no matter the state or zip code they live in.
Sarah, thank you so much for being on World Wide Wave.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our very special guest, Senator-elect Sarah McBride, the first trans state senator in U.S. history, with us right here on Joy 94.9.
A huge thank you tonight to Sarah McBride, the first trans state senator elected in the USA. And you can have a look at her website, sarahmcbride.com.
Also, a big thank you to everyone that interacted with us on Facebook. That's Richard, Liz, Dee Dee, Nicole, Kathy, and heap more. So you can find us on Facebook. It's very easy. It's just W3Joy.
Thank you so much to those behind the scenes who make this podcast possible, our podcaster Peter and our social media master Dean. And a big shout out to our World Wide Wave correspondent tonight, Ian Munchmore.
Thanks for listening to another podcast from World Wide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. World Wide Wave is the international news and current affairs show on Australia's LGBT radio station Joy 94.9. You can listen live every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. Eastern Australian Time on 94.9 FM in Melbourne and online at joy.org.au. You'll find all our podcasts at joy.org.au/worldwidewave or follow us on Facebook for the latest international LGBT news. Search W3Joy on Facebook now.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.